Good evening. Welcome to Council Connection for the month of June. I'm your host, Steve Dresser. It's hard to believe, but we've finally come into spring here in New England. I didn't think we ever would. It was cold and damp and rainy and more of the same. But all of a sudden, the warm temperatures are coming. We're even getting a taste of summer here and there, and for me, that can't come soon enough. This month, we'll be listening to presentations from the Friday afternoon session of our BSCB Spring Convention, which was held at the Burlington Marriott on March 8th, 9th, and 10th. We'll be hearing about services provided by the Veterans Administration. We'll learn about the Real ID, an important new development in Massachusetts and in the United States at large. But we'll begin by talking about a major event that's about to happen in Rochester, New York. Of course, I'm referring to the 2019 ACB National Conference and Convention, which will be held from July 5th to July 12th. If you've never been to a national conference and convention, it's well worth your time to consider going. It's not too late to register. Registration is open until the 22nd of June, and there's a lot to do. Of course, there are the usual things, exhibits, which is one of my personal favorites, the general sessions, from which you can learn an awful lot of good information about every conceivable topic, and a host of presentations by special interest affiliates such as the American Association of Blind Teachers, ACB Radio Amateurs, ACB Diabetics, and a host of others. To find out more about this year's annual conference and convention, visit www.convention.acb.org. That's www.convention.acb.org. We're all familiar with the various forms of IDs that we need to present when we go traveling anywhere, especially by air. Of course, for most people, it's a driver's license. For many of us, it's an ID card. But next year, the federal government is planning to roll out yet another form of ID, this one known as the Real ID. Here's Michelle Zelick to explain what that means to folks in Massachusetts.
Big changes going on at the Registry of Motor Vehicles in terms of identification cards and driver's licenses. So, and you may have heard that we are now able to issue something called a Real ID. And what that means is that the Real ID is a federally compliant credential. And that will allow a person to board an airplane to travel within to fly within the United States, starting October 1st of the year 2020. So let me just backtrack a little bit and tell you why we have this thing called a Real ID. And it's actually as a result of 9/11. When 9/11 happened back in 2001, Congress got together and created the Homeland Security Act, okay? And out of the Homeland Security Act was created the Real ID Act. And so believe it or not, the Real ID Act was passed back in 2005. And it's a federal mandate. Every state must comply with the Real ID Act. And what that means is that the Registry of Motor Vehicles now has to require additional documentation of a person if they want to apply for a Mass ID card or apply for a driver's license, or even when they renew their existing ID card or driver's license. Everyone now in the United States, if they want to get a license or an ID, everyone must prove lawful presence. So that's a new step in the renewal process. And again, it's all due to 9/11, and it's a federal mandate. So we are able to issue two kinds of credentials. One is a standard level of credential, and the other one is this federally compliant Real ID. So you decide which one you want. There's no difference in price. If you get the Real ID during your renewal phase of your Mass ID. I hope everyone here holds a Massachusetts ID card because it's critical that you have a valid form of identification, right? For a whole lot of reasons. But anyway, know that you can now turn that Mass ID card into a federally compliant Mass ID card. And so for security to identify a real ID, your Mass ID is going to have a little white star in the top right-hand corner if it's a real ID. Same thing with the driver's licenses. If somebody holds a real ID compliant driver's license, it's just going to look like their regular license, but it's going to have a little white star in the top right-hand corner. That's what the federal government is depicting on licenses and ID cards for security to determine whether or not it's a federally compliant ID card. So, do you know when it will be required of a person to, in order to fly within the United States or enter a secure federal office building? What's the date that we need to have our real ID by? You got it. October 1st of the year 2020. So you have pretty much a year and a half to decide whether or not you want this thing called a real ID. But we anticipate quite a crowd at the registry, as you can imagine. Probably next summer, you know, the summer of 2020, people are going to begin to realize that, I'm flying in October and I don't have a real ID. But here's the thing. If you have a valid passport, you can use that. So you don't need a real ID if you have a valid passport and if you intend on keeping your passport valid, right? So what the Real ID Act says is that if a person wants to board an airplane to fly within the U.S., they're going to have to show TSA either a real ID or a valid passport or even a military ID. So those folks who have a military ID, and thank you for your service, you will be able to show that military ID, and that will allow you to board the airplane, okay? Now, the Real ID Act has said nothing about travel by bus or travel by train yet, okay? So know that to keep yourselves informed, you know, the Real ID Act has had some modifications to it, so I can't tell you what's going to be required of you, you know, next year or, you know, in terms of what other restrictions there are, but I'm telling you, as of today, the Real ID Act says, come October 1st of the year 2020, the only way you'll be able to board an airplane to fly within the U.S., or the only way you'll be able to enter secure federal office buildings is by showing a real ID or by showing a valid passport or by showing a military ID. Okay. So there's a question in the back. Yes, sir. The question was, this real ID, will a real ID be required to also enter federal, congressional buildings? Yes, absolutely. The key is, if there is a security desk in that federal building, you're going to have to show a real ID or a passport or a military ID. And like I said, you know, the federal government has been tweaking this Real ID Act a little bit. So always, you know, before you travel, it's a really good idea to go online to TSA's website or to our website. Our website is fully accessible. And that's where the, you know, the most up-to-date information will be. So any other questions as
Michelle,
to...
Michelle, I have a question.
Yes, Frank, yeah.
My passport, and I also have a passport card, both of them have a chip in it. Do the real IDs from the Commonwealth have any type of either passive, active identification chips in them?
You know, that's a great question, Frank. I know that the Real ID driver's license or ID card has your demographic information. It has restrictions. In terms of a chip, I'd have to find out and get back to you on that. That's a great question. And I don't know. I don't know. Okay. So let me start from the front of the room. There are two hands up. So I'd like to take the first table. Yes, ma'am, your question. Okay, terrific. Here's a great question, and it's both are terrific questions. So the question that I just received is my ID is up for renewal this year. What do I need to do? Okay, so first thing is you need to decide whether or not you want to get yourself a real ID. So that's the first thing. And second thing is to go, well, I brought copies with me, but I'm sorry, it's not large print copies, but what I have is a checklist. It's called the Identification Documents Checklist, and this is online, and you can get this checklist, and this will help you figure out what documents do you need in order to bring in order to get a real ID, or even if you don't want the real ID, what documents do you need to bring in to renew your mass ID? Maybe you have no interest in the real ID. You just want to maintain a standard level of identification card. Well, that's great too, but you're going to still need to bring in some extra documentation to even do that. So a Massachusetts ID card costs $25 to renew. Okay. And for those who don't have a Massachusetts ID card, it costs $25 to obtain an ID card. Okay. For those who drive, it costs $50 to renew a driver's license here in Massachusetts, or to even apply for a Massachusetts driver license costs $50. So the ID costs $25. What you will need to do in order to renew your Mass ID is prove lawful presence. And the checklist that I have lists 11 documents that we accept at the registry to prove lawful presence. Okay. I can quickly touch upon probably the most common documents that people are bringing in to prove lawful presence. One is a valid U.S. passport. Or a valid U.S. passport card. So if you currently hold a passport and it is valid, bring that with you to the Registry of Motor Vehicles, because that's a document that is required to prove lawful presence. If it has expired, if your passport has expired, don't bother bringing it with you to the registry to prove lawful presence, because we cannot accept it, okay? By law, we cannot accept any expired documentation. And again, that's noted on the checklist. So all documents that you bring in to us must be originals. So if you do not have a passport, don't worry. There are 10 other documents you can choose from to prove lawful presence. One is a United States birth certificate. Must be issued by the municipality, though. Keep that in mind. Maybe you have a birth certificate that you got from the hospital where you were born. Or maybe you have a baptismal certificate from a church or someplace. That is not acceptable. We can only accept a United States birth certificate that was issued by the city or town, either where you were born or where you were first issued this birth certificate. Has to be an original. If you cannot find your original birth certificate, you'll have to contact the city or town that issued your birth certificate and get what's called a certified version. And that means it will have a stamp, a notarized stamp, a raised seal on it. So keep that in mind. But again, it's one or the other. So if you have a passport, I would say use that to prove lawful presence. If you don't have a passport, use your birth certificates. Gotta be an original. Gotta be issued by the municipality. Now here's where it gets a little tricky. If you're interested in getting the real ID, and you bring us a birth certificate to prove lawful presence, and the first name or the last name that appear on your birth certificate are different from your current name, the Real ID Act requires that the customer also bring in proof that they changed their name. Okay, in the form of a marriage certificate or a divorce decree or a court document. So again, I'll repeat it because it gets a little tricky. So if the document that you are bringing to us to prove lawful presence shows a different first or last name than your current name, you've got to also bring in proof that you changed your name. So that happens, I think, mostly for folks that are going to bring in a birth certificate to prove lawful presence. Because sometimes, you know, it might be the maiden name on the birth certificate, and then they've gotten married. It's a different name that they have now. If that's your case, you're going to have to bring in your marriage certificate from the city or the town where you applied for your marriage license, okay? And then if you got a divorce and changed your name back to your maiden name, and then you got married again, you're going to have to bring in your first marriage certificate, your divorce decree, and then your second marriage certificate, okay? So you got to show us the paper trail. Yeah, yeah, it gets quite, I don't know. You know, the beautiful thing about working for the registry, everyone has a story to tell, and that's what I love about my job. But so that's why I really appreciate this opportunity too, Frank, because there's some nitty-gritty detail to this law that we've had to turn a lot of customers away because maybe they brought in an expired passport, or maybe they want the real ID, but the name's different on their birth certificate. So I want to save you that time of having to be turned away. The other thing I want to let you know, if you're a part of a low vision support group, maybe, or you've got a community group that you work with and you want the registry to come and talk to your group, I would be more than happy. Laurie, does anyone know Laurie Worley? Yeah, yeah. Okay, Ann, yeah, yeah. Well, Ann and Laurie Worley and all the wonderful folks that I get to work with are keeping me really busy. And I love that I get to go to all sorts of groups and help people figure out if you need a real ID or not. And if you want one, what you're going to have to do to get it. Okay? So, yes, thank you for waiting. Yes, question toward the back. What about people who are here living in the United States and they have a green card? And we can absolutely accept a green card, a valid green card. That is one of the 11 documents that prove lawful presence. So as you know, a valid passport, a U.S. birth certificate, a green card, an employment authorization document. So there are lots of folks that are living here in the U.S., working, and they have an EAD or an employment authorization document. That, in the eyes of the federal government, proves lawful presence. Even a foreign passport with a visa affixed to it, that can prove lawful presence. So in those cases, though, if someone is not a U.S. citizen and does not have either a birth certificate or a U.S. passport, we can issue an ID or a license if they have, you know, a green card or a foreign passport with a visa or a certificate of citizenship or a certificate of naturalization. But on some of the temporary documents, like the work authorization document, EAD, employment authorization document, that's usually for about 1 to 2, maybe 3 years. So we can issue even a license, driver's license or an ID card to that person, but we can only issue it to them for whatever time is on their employment authorization document, right? So for Massachusetts residents who are living here permanently, we issue you an ID card and you've got it for 5 years. But someone who is on a temporary lawful presence document, we can only issue them an ID card or a license for the amount of time they're authorized to be here in the country. So it's just handled a little bit differently, but great question. So in all, 11 documents prove lawful presence and they're all listed on the checklist. Yes, sir. Thank you for waiting. Okay, excellent question. In terms of getting imaged or having your photo taken at the registry, we call it taking your image. What is allowed? And according to the law that we need to follow, our customers must remove their eyeglasses for the image. However, if there is a medical reason why that pair of eyeglasses cannot be removed, that is allowed. But really, in terms of facial recognition requires that anyone who is obtaining an ID or a driver's license from any state motor vehicle agency must remove anything that covers their face. So no one's allowed to wear a hat, except if it is for religious purposes. Okay. Now, in terms of, as you said, eye patch and right, prosthetics, I would have to check with medical affairs because that's a great question. And I don't know the answer to that. All I know is in terms of complying with facial recognition, we're supposed to ask the customer to remove his or her eyeglasses. But for folks, for blind folks, I'm going to have to double check with medical affairs. Retinal? Well, you know, again, a follow-up question. Are they the part of the facial recognition, and I know some, you know, maybe someday we'll get to retinal scans, but I don't know. I think the technology is probably heading that way, but of course, that doesn't work. So, yes, in the back, thank you for waiting. Hand up, yes? Okay, great question. No, that's not all you have to say, Jerry. That's a great question. So what you need to do is, first of all, complete an application. That's probably the second step. First step is deciding which one you want, standard or real ID. Second step is completing an application, which is available online. And in fact, I could send to Frank or to my contacts, an electronic version of the application, and you will find at the top of the application, there is a question that asks the customer, which would you like, standard credential or real ID credential? And you check off either one. Very important that you check that off, because if you do not check off either one, we will automatically default to the standard form of identification. So very, very important that you check that off, that you want the real ID. And then, of course, as you know, you fill out the rest of the application and bring that with you along with all of your documentation. Now, I only got to the first step of the documentation, so I want to quickly, and I know I'm on borrowed time. I won't take too much longer, but so first step is, in terms of documentation, the first step is proving lawful presence. And as I said, 11 documents are allowed. You only need to bring in one of those 11 documents to prove lawful presence. Once you have proven lawful presence by bringing that document into us, we'll scan it into our system. We'll type in the serial number of that document into our database, and then it will get electronically verified with the federal government's SAVE system, okay? And that takes a second or two. So while you're waiting there at the counter, or for some of you, you may be able to do that step online ahead of time if you're using a passport. Most passports you will be able to verify lawful presence electronically, and that will save you time at the registry, okay? So if you're going to use your U.S. passport to prove lawful presence, you may be able to get that step done online ahead of time. You're still going to have to bring your passport in with you if you want the real ID, because keep in mind, anyone who wants the real ID, they must come in person. Even if you fill out your application online, you have proven lawful presence online, you've proven your social security number online, you still have to complete the process in person to get a real ID. If you're not interested in the real ID, you may be eligible to renew your Mass ID online. You don't have to bother coming into the registry. You can now, now we allow people to renew their driver's licenses if they're younger than 75 years old. And we allow people to renew their ID cards at any age, of course, two consecutive times in a row online, okay? But if you want the real ID, you're going to have to come in person and do that. If you are, or a family member is a AAA member, that member can renew his or her ID or driver's license at AAA. Keep that in mind, too. AAA is also allowed and able to issue real ID compliant identification cards. So, excuse me, they're not allowed to issue them, but they're allowed to renew them, okay? Same as driver's licenses, okay? All right, so first step, prove lawful presence. Second step is proving your name change, if that's going to be an issue, depending on the document you bring in to prove lawful presence. Third step is proving your social security number. So you will need, if you want the real ID, to bring in your social security card. If it has been laminated, we cannot accept it. Yep. That's been another big reason why we've had to turn people away, because they've brought to us their social security card, but it has been laminated. The Real ID Act says we cannot accept any laminated documents because we scan everything that you give to us, with the exception of your Mass ID card, right? Because that's laminated, but we gave it to you. So that we don't need to scan in. But any other document that we're required to collect, we must scan it in. So that's why we cannot accept laminated documents. So if your social security card has been laminated, well, you could bring in an alternate document, or you could contact SSA and request a replacement of your social security card. But alternate documents are a 1099 form that has your 9-digit social on it, a 1099 form that's issued by either Social Security Administration or some other financial institution, a W-2 form that has your 9-digit social on it, a pay stub that has your name and your 9-digit social on it, and last but not least, a Social Security number denial notice that has been issued by Social Security Administration. So for the folks that want the real ID, you've got to bring in proof of your Social Security number. If you don't want the real ID, you just have to tell the clerk what your Social Security number is. We're not going to scan any Social Security document in if you don't want the real ID. So that's almost the last step. The last step is proving Massachusetts residency. You've done this forever. If you've lived here in Massachusetts, you've always had to prove Massachusetts residency. If you want the real ID, though, you now have to bring in two documents that prove Massachusetts residency. You'll notice when you do access the document checklist, you will notice that page 2 lists about 25 documents, and any two of those documents are documents that you can bring in to prove Massachusetts residency. Examples are your current Massachusetts ID card. If it hasn't expired, that you can use as one proof of Massachusetts residency. Other documents we accept are bills dated within 60 days of your visit to the registry. For instance, cell phone bills, utility bills, credit card statements. The key is, if you're going to prove Mass residency by using a piece of mail, that piece of mail must show your name as well as your residential address on it. We cannot accept pieces of mail that show your post office box, nor can we accept pieces of mail that are addressed to you in care of. Okay, so the key is, if you're going to prove Mass residency, make sure that that document, whether it's a bank statement or a utility bill, make sure it has your name and your residential address on it, okay? So, but really, most people will bring in a recent bill, a recent statement, checking account or savings account statement. If you do banking online, or if you pay your bills online, you can print out your most recent statement, online statement, and we will accept that. Remember I said all documents must be originals? Well, the state legislature made an exception and said, yes, for folks that are doing online bill payment or banking, we are able to accept a printout of your most recent statement. And that is it. That's how you now renew your Mass ID. I know it's a lot to digest, but again, the biggest question, I suppose, to the customer is, which type of credential do you want? Do you want the standard level of credential or do you want the real ID? That's probably the biggest question to ask yourselves. And again, if you have a U.S. passport, you don't need to have a real ID, but the convenience of having that real ID might be appealing to you, right? Because you wouldn't have to dig out your passport every time you fly within the United States. You could use your Mass ID card if it's a real ID. Any other questions, comments, suggestions?
One question.
Yes. If you're in Massachusetts, so the question I'll repeat for folks in the back, if you get the real ID, how long does it last? The answer is if you're a Massachusetts resident, you will be issued a real ID that's good for 5 years, and then you might be able to renew that online the next time. So you don't have to keep proving lawful presence. Once you have proven lawful presence here in Massachusetts, you don't have to do that step again, which is good. But if you're a permanent resident, you'll be issued an ID card, excuse me, a real ID, or even a standard ID for 5 years.
You're listening to Council Connection. The show airs on the first Thursday of every month on the Talking Information Center Network at 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern and on the second Tuesday of the month on ACB Radio Mainstream at 9 p.m. Eastern. You can also hear us on the BSCB Fillmore box at 773-572-6312 or by visiting the Council Connection archives at www.acbofma.org. For many of us, World War II is something we read about in history books. But for those who served in the war, June 6th is a very significant day. It marks the anniversary of the invasion of Normandy, which was a turning point in the war for the United States. And with that in mind, I think it's only appropriate that we think about our Veterans Administration, which provides several services to those who serve in various wars. I didn't know a whole lot about it until I heard our next presenters at our spring convention, and here they are to introduce themselves and to tell us more about the services provided by the VA.
So I'm Kelly J. Roz. I'm from the VA, and I have Amber Valancourt here and Chris J. Roz. And we all work at the VA in central western Massachusetts, which is Worcester West. But we're here to talk about the VA overall, answer your questions, and kind of provide you with contacts if you need them within the VA. How many veterans do we have in here? Nobody? Veterans. You, right? Yeah, I thought I saw a veteran card. So, well, thank you for your service. Thank you. And now, this didn't really work out the way we wanted, but does any of the veterans in the room use the VA? Oh, good. All right. Okay. That's good. I'm the visual impairment coordinator. So I case manage all the veterans. And we'll talk about what each of us do. And Amber and Chris are what we call the blind rehab outpatient specialists. And they do the training for the veterans that are in the outpatient clinics.
Hi, everybody. My name's Chris. Just to get us started off, one of the unique things about the VA is that the VA is the first completely integrated rehab services for the visually impaired and active duty service members in the country. Well, actually in the world. So that makes it a little bit different than some of the state services because we have everything from primary care docs right through physical therapy, occupational therapists, blind rehab specialists, all working under the same roof, all on the same team that makes the care that we provide a little bit different than some of you might receive in the community. So Kelly and I both work out of the Leeds campus VA, so in Northampton, yep, very close to Springfield, and Amber works out of our Worcester clinic on Plantation Street.
Well, thank you for having us, for letting us take our show here to the road with you guys. So a little bit about the blind rehab service model of care. So the programs include the visual impairment services team coordinator, which if you know anything about the VA or the government, we like acronyms, so it's shortened to VIST coordinator. Then there's blind rehabilitation outpatient specialist, which is shortened to bros. So Chris and I are bros, and Kelly is the VIST. And then there are basic, intermediate, and advanced low vision clinics. There is vision impairment services outpatient rehab programs, which shortened to visors. And then there are inpatient blind rehab centers called BRCs. So that's like the Carroll Center, if you guys, I'm sure you're all familiar with the Carroll Center. And then there's visual impairment centers to optimize remaining sight programs, and that is called a Victor's program. So in New England, we fall under the kind of how the VA has the country divided up is in VISNs. And so in New England, we're VISN 1, and the following programs are available, and we're going to discuss them today. So veterans can take advantage of any of the National Blind Rehab Services. So I'm repeating myself. So that's the VIST coordinators, bros, those different low vision clinics, basic, intermediate, and advanced, the BRCs, the blind rehab centers. So that makes up what we've got going on here in VISN 1.
Yeah, so yeah. That's just the New England area. So the VA categorize, again, the VA has to make it complicated. They can't say the New England area. They have to come up with their own definition of what area of the country it is. So that just defines what New England is. So like Amber was saying, I'm the VIST coordinator, and pretty much it's my job to help you navigate the VA. It's my job to help you as a veteran enroll in the VA. It's my job to help you obtain services to help you overcome your vision loss, which might include working with optometry and low vision optometry. It could include working with mental health. It could include audiology. So it's my job to help you get to where you need to go and at least point you in the right direction to answer questions. And every year, the VIST coordinator, there's one at every assigned to every VA hospital and clinic. So I cover Northampton and Worcester. Some of the other VIST coordinators also cover other areas, multiple areas. But we are there to offer you every year the opportunity to come in and have your eyes checked, your ears checked, see your VA doctor, because we like to see you once a year just to make sure you're receiving the care that you need. But it's not always necessarily about your vision loss. We have veterans that might need more help in the home. So, I help them get set up with home health services. Sometimes they need nursing support in the home. So I help them get those services that they need to hopefully help them stay in their home as long as possible. And I work, Chris had mentioned this, so I don't want to talk about too much, but I work with a team. So it's very often that we're working with optometry and audiology, and we're all under the same roof. So we do have a team that we work with.
So a little bit about what Chris and I do as bros, or blind rehab outpatient specialists, is we work on the training, like Kelly said, the blind rehab services. So we work in the competencies of O&M skills, long cane training, living skills, manual skills, visual skills, and assistive technology. We will provide those services in veterans' homes, at VA medical centers. So like I work in a community-based outpatient clinic or a CBOC, or this might take place at the main campus in Leeds where Chris works. Oh, we might meet up with you at a college if you're a veteran and you're in school, or your work site. I've met veterans who work at Home Depot before, or in long-term care environments like nursing homes or assisted living facilities. So we work with the VIST coordinator, Kelly, on these referrals. And, yeah, we're just constantly working with the veterans to assess their current skill level and their needs and what their goals are as they change. We do a lot of prep training prior to admission if someone's going to go to a blind rehab center. And then we do follow-up training when they come home. Let's say that you're a veteran and you just can't go to a blind rehab center for that training. So we're going to do our best to provide similar training at your home locally instead of sending you off. Yeah, and we also work with veterans' families and the folks that support them in their daily life to help make sure that they're able to support the veterans appropriately.
So when a veteran comes to the VA, they have lots of choices, and we sort of pride ourselves on what we call the continuum of care model, which means the right care at the right time in the right place. So the VIS coordinator, sort of the tip of that spear, as Kelly has talked about, and the blind rehab outpatient specialists are the folks that are going to come out and meet you in the community. But we also have some other options. We have low vision clinics. We actually have three tiers of low vision clinics, a basic low vision clinic, which would be available at every VA that has optometry care, where you could go in and get some basic eye care, maybe identify that you need a handheld magnifier or something to that effect. We have intermediate clinics that are a little bit higher tier, but they're not at every facility. There's actually only one in New England, in New Hampshire.
White River Junction.
White River Junction, I'm sorry, White River Junction. And then we have advanced clinics as well, and I think the big one in New England is out in Boston. And then our inpatient blind rehab programs, they're sort of like the crown jewel of blind rehab in the VA, as Amber said, very much like the Carroll Center, which is an inpatient program where veterans go, they stay over a course of maybe 4 to 6 weeks or more, depending on what their needs are, where they're trained to do all of the things that people with vision loss might need to be able to do. I'm guessing that you are probably familiar with that already. So.
We've got a question. Two questions. Nice. So we don't very often need to send our veterans to Boston, thankfully. We are not defined as an advanced outpatient low vision clinic, but we are an advanced outpatient low vision clinic in Worcester. But unfortunately, in order to get from North Brookfield to the Worcester clinic, we do not have an extra transportation source. It's just what's available through that community. We do at times resort, you know, we outreach to the Association for the Blind. Sharon knows about, you know, because they do have some of the services. So we'll point them in that direction. We also do have a volunteer transportation pool, which consists of the Disabled American Vets. They have like a pool of veterans that provide rides. And then the VA has some funding for a driver to come. So sometimes we are able to do that if there really is not another alternative. Katie is no longer the VIST coordinator in Boston. I didn't bring that sheet up. It's Kate. It's on here. Kate Bergamasto. She just started the last few months in Mary. But we are in touch at least once a month, the group of us from New England. We hold a conference call so that we can all touch base and share information and stories. So we're very familiar with everyone in New England. But yes, there are shuttles if the veteran needs to get to Boston. But what you've seen in the VA over the last few years is this, they're going towards choice. So veterans don't need to go to Boston anymore for ophthalmology care. 5 years ago, there was no other alternative. Now the VA can refer them in the community, and the VA will, you know, assume that cost for that service. So it's a little bit different nowadays. So obviously it varies from site to site how many blind veterans they have on what they call their roster. So my roster is a great example. A year ago, I had 365 veterans on it. So, no, we keep them forever. They're ours forever. What is happening is what we've been told was going to happen for the last 10 years. As of last week, I was down to 295. Okay, so our veterans are 85 and older. That's been our majority for a long time. And unfortunately, they're passing away quicker than we are adding new veterans. They told us this was going to happen in 2005. Then they said 2010. Well, it's finally happening in 2019. Our 90-year-olds are healthy stock, and they've definitely, I think, outlived. But I have 365, well, now I'm down to 295. I think in our area, Providence has the largest amount because they serve Rhode Island and the Cape. And I think they're about 400-something. So that will give you an idea of in New England, most of us have 200 to about 425 veterans that we are responsible for case managing. So the biggest question we get, Chris, sorry.
Now might be a good time to mention the handout that we have just with contact
information. We had sent to Sharon. So thank you, Sharon, for helping facilitate all this. Just all the contact numbers for everyone in New England in case you needed to contact someone at a VA in the New England area. So you always want to contact the person that has my job, the visual impairment coordinator. We're on site most often. We're the ones that help with enrollment, meaning getting them into the VA, and can help with those questions. So the biggest question I get asked is what makes someone eligible for the VA? And you might hear from, if you work with veterans, because I know some of you work with veterans, I tried to apply to the VA 10 years ago, and I didn't get into the VA. So there are certain criteria for veterans, the war period you served, the number of days, and anyone that served after 1980, there's actually a much, much different eligibility. The bottom line is, for veterans that served before 1980, if you were honorably discharged, even if you were less than honorably discharged, okay, they have all sorts of categories. If you are legally blind, you're eligible to enroll in the VA. So if you served before 1980, and if you're not entirely sure, which happened a couple weeks ago, just have us call the veterans so that we can point them in the right direction. So if they served before that, and all they need is a copy of that discharge paper. Most veterans know where it is because it's important to them. And then their certificate of blindness from the state. And then a VA application, which is 2 pages signed. That's all we need from them. And if it comes to me, I can make sure it gets into the system. If they go to the Worcester Clinic and they show up and try to enroll, they're probably going to get denied if they're over income because they don't know what to do with the certificate of blindness. So always go through your local VIST coordinator because they can help make sure they get to where they need to go and get into the VA system accurately. Anyone that served after 1980, it's a case-by-case basis. And I've been doing this for 19 years. I've had my first veteran denied within the last few months. That's because he served after 1980. So that was new to me. So the veterans that served after 1980, we have to really look at them case by case and make sure they meet other criteria besides legal blindness. If someone's not legally blind, if they're visually impaired, maybe they're working with the Association for the Blind, not the Commission for the Blind, they have to be just eligible for the VA based upon their time in the service. And we can help them with that as well. Again, not something that someone is often denied eligibility for. But it has happened a couple times. So why is it important for the veteran to come to us with the legal blindness category? It's because if they're legally blind, they have no payment for VA outpatient services and inpatient stays. So all their appointments are free with us. If they need to see audiology, it's free. Podiatry, optometry, they don't have to pay for those appointments. You know, when we go to the dentist, you got to pay your $30, $40 copay. The VA has that for other veterans, but if you're legally blind, you do not have a copay. And any equipment that is recommended, you do not pay for. Okay, so what does that mean? If you need a hearing aid, the VA is going to provide it to you. It doesn't cost you anything for the hearing aid. The VA helps you maintain it, and they send you batteries in the mail. Okay, if you're, for our population, The number one thing is the equipment relative to vision loss. Number two is hearing aids. But if you need anything if you have goals and it's recommended that you need a handheld magnifier or closed circuit television or any type of equipment, the VA is able to provide that to you. And we provide the training, whether it's people like Chris and Amber, our bros that do the training, we will make sure that the veteran knows how to use the equipment. So our local blind rehab center is in West Haven, Connecticut. And yes, if the veteran is medically able to attend the program, we will send them to West Haven. We will also send them to Tucson, and we'll also send them to Palo Alto. Those are the three that we've used over the last couple years. So a veteran has to have the big piece is being medically stable to go. But yes, there are 13 of them in the nation. Yes, in the back with the blue shirt. Yeah, well, we obviously nationwide, we all work together as blind rehab specialists, but we do not work with Hines because of travel. So Tucson and Palo Alto will fly our veterans there and back for free. So they have grants. Someone passed away and left them lots of money to do that. So we've been going there because West Haven usually has 32 beds, but has been functioning for a while at 10 beds. So we've been sending veterans out to other hospitals that might want to have services a little bit quicker. But that's a good question. Yes, we do use the inpatient programs.
Kelly, and there's no reason if a veteran did want to go to Hines as opposed to another facility, that's their choice. The only issue is the VA doesn't necessarily pay for that travel. But if a veteran wanted to go to Hines because that's where they wanted to go, then they could absolutely put an application in there and go, along with the other 13 blind centers in the country.
And Jerry knows this best. If we ever had somebody that really, I had a veteran that because of dialysis wanted to go to another center that had dialysis affiliated with it, the Blind Veterans Association was willing to pay for him to get there and back. So there are other resources. If someone really wants to or needs to go to other blind center, we'll make it happen. When I first started in this role, because I did work at West Haven before I took the job I have now, I sent 30 veterans at least a year to inpatient blind rehab. Out of my 300 veterans, over 200 of them are 85 and older. So how many applications have I done this year? Zero, for the first time ever. So, yeah, it's because it sounds odd, but you have to be medically, they want you to go to inpatient blind rehab and just do inpatient blind rehab. You have to be healthy to attend. And some people are like, well, why? You're in a hospital. Because they want you to focus on obtaining, you know, the equipment and the skills that you need.
In our New England VISN here, we've got 8 full-time VIST coordinators, 8 full-time bros, and 1 low-vision therapist.
Do you want to do the? So essentially, you know, what Amber's saying and what we had said before, there's someone that has my job, the coordinator, at every VA facility throughout New England. And now all of the VAs except for one have someone that can do the training in their home that's a staff member. The other VAs will pay an agency like Future Insight or the commission for the Carroll Center to do the training if they don't have anyone on staff to do it. So that's what we have in New England. And so essentially, and I think I've already said this, but it's never wrong to give us a call and ask us if someone that you're working with or someone that you know is eligible. That's what I'm here for. And we're here as coordinators to help you help people understand the process. It's overwhelming. My first name's Kelly. J-Roz. J-A-R-O-S as in Sam, Z as in zebra. Northampton, yep, and Worcester. Mm-hmm, both. We're very lucky. We just, in September, obtained some clerical help. So if you call our number, which is for the VA, if you dial the main number, if anyone wants it, I can give it to them. But Lee is our clerk. She helps answer the phones because Chris and Amber are on the road 4 days a week. And so what was happening is their voicemails were just piling up, and so we wanted a location. And then I meet with veterans during the day. So Lee just helps us, and if she can answer the call, she does. But if I need to call someone back, she just takes the message, and I call them back when I'm free. She is lovely. You're right, Sharon. She's very sweet. Our veterans, they're pretty protective, and they don't really – they give people a hard time, and Lee won them over very quickly. So they rely on her a lot. So if you are a veteran, the VA gives you preferential hiring. There's like a bunch of different categories in human resources, but you get a preference for hiring. The person interviewing you or reviewing the applications has to have a really good reason why they're not hiring a veteran. A qualified veteran. And I want to say that because obviously you have people that apply for jobs that they're not qualified for. But if you, yep. So the veterans get preference for hiring, and you've seen a big shift in the VA in the last 10 years with veteran hiring as a result of that, which has been great. Yes, here in the red sweater. All three of us here are orientation and mobility specialists. But most of the bros do have an orientation and mobility certification. All bros have at least one certification through ACVREP. A lot of them have two. So vision rehab therapy, low vision, CADIS is new. So those are what the person would need. And that's a VA requirement. You have to have at least one certification in those areas to be a blind rehab outpatient specialist. If you did not have an orientation and mobility degree, which is the case with one of our bros in this area, then yes, they do use an orientation and mobility specialist for advanced orientation and mobility training. Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much.
And with that, we come to the end of Council Connection for the month of June. If you have any questions or comments about anything you've heard on the show, please leave us a message in the BSCB Fillmore box at 773-572-6312. I'm your host, Steve Dresser, looking forward to seeing many of you in Rochester this year and inviting you to join us again in July for another edition of Council Connection. Enjoy the summer and take care.